Hello, and thank you for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. My name is William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk to stay updated with the latest episodes. And check out the website armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com to find show notes and other related links that you may find interesting. Also, there's a special deal, special for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address www.hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. It's cheaper than Amazon, and buying a book this way is a good way for you to help support this podcast. The latest addition to the offer is sociologist Olivier Roy's new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State, which has just been published, and which I've just finished reading actually, and I can say it's very good. All the other books on the list available at cut price are written by authors who have previously featured on this podcast. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontent by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, and Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter. So to order any of those titles for a third off, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and in that way you can help support the Turkey Book Talk podcast. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from Turkey Book Talk, is via my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the usual Turkey Book Talk pages. But let's get cracking with this latest episode, and in it I speak to Kapka Kasabova, the author of a new book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe, which was recently published by Granta to rave reviews. The book blends memoir, travelogue and history, as Kasabova describes a journey on the frontier between Turkey, Bulgaria and Greece. Back when she was growing up in Sofia, this was the sometimes deadly front line of the Cold War, the cut-off point between the Warsaw Pact countries of the Soviet bloc and NATO members Greece and Turkey. It's also a place where the Mediterranean and Balkan currents meet, and has for centuries been a place of migration, ethno-religious mixing, and bloodshed. The book delves into this history and looks at some of the modern-day echoes in this part of the world. Kasabova today lives a long way away from this area, in the Scottish Highlands in fact, and I started by asking her to talk about what prompted her to write this book at this time.
In the first instance, what intrigued me about the border region was simply the sense that there were a lot of untold stories along that border. I stumbled into a village, a border village, in 2013, the summer of that year, and saw some interesting pagan rites being sort of reenacted by the locals, and got talking to people. And started hearing all sorts of stories, legends, personal histories to do with different points in time that I thought were absolutely fascinating. And I wanted to learn more. And that's how the journey began.
And you were born in Bulgaria before you emigrated to New Zealand in your teens, I think. And now you live in Scotland. So it's a really winding path that brought you back. Could you just talk a bit about your childhood, growing up in this area, and what it was that drew you back over time?
Yes, I seem to have come full circle. I grew up in Sofia in the 70s and 80s. It was the dying days, the last decade and a half of the Cold War, of totalitarian communism. And growing up, I was, like most people in the Eastern Bloc, quite aware of the nature of hard borders, which was really what the Iron Curtain was. It was the ultimate hard border. And I've always been intrigued by the different manifestations of borders, you know, what shapes borders take physically, but also in people's minds and hearts, and how borders can shape people's lives, perhaps because I was so aware of it as a child. So I was always going to make a journey back to the border, which was the old Iron Curtain. But what surprised me was that it turned out to be much more than that. A much older place, haunted by much older ghosts and histories.
And in this part of the world, I mean, the book gives plenty of opportunity to reflect on the many ironies of this area. And you get this very striking sense reading the book of how this area of the Balkans, actually just like the rest of the Balkans, was this once an extraordinary area of diversity and mixing. But now it's the site of these very hard, blood-soaked borders, really, and a kind of strong nationalism, many different kinds of nationalism. And what the book does, it gives you this sense, it kind of navigates in between these apparently hard positions that people have and finds the kind of the gaps in between and the ironies of these positions that people take. Was that a deliberate attempt on your part to seek out these almost paradoxical, ironic stories of people in this area?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I guess I'm very pleased, first of all, to hear that is happening in the book, that there is a connecting human thread. I didn't go in with any kind of agenda or preconceived idea because I was simply ignorant about this area. I didn't know what I was going to find. All I knew was that I wanted to meet people and hear their stories and try and somehow make sense of what happened along this border. And I received wonderful gifts of stories from a whole range of different people and communities. And yes, these stories were full of ironies, of echoes of one another, of paradoxes, not all of them tragic. There was a lot of humor as well. But as you say, it was the very hardness of the border that during the Cold War that hardened people's attitudes. But one of the fascinating discoveries for me was to see how people survive and make sense of events, of their own lives, as we all must do, and how people tell the story of their life and of their ancestors' lives. And there are so many different ways to tell a story. So in that sense, all I had to do was listen.
One of the great ironies really is that for many decades, this was, as you say, a kind of area of hard borders. And during the Cold War, thousands of people tried to flee from across the Eastern, from across the Warsaw Pact countries and the Soviet Union, through Bulgaria, into Greece and Turkey, which were both members of NATO. And there were hundreds killed trying to do this. But today, of course, there's this other human flow going in the opposite direction that you comment on in the book, as you observe the refugees from Syria who are trapped in these kind of borderlands trying to get through this border from Turkey into Europe. Could you just comment on that aspect of this kind of new migration flow that you observe in the book?
Yes, that was very striking, and it will be striking for anyone who goes there now, that the channels, the corridors of migration, the corridors of escape, if you like, are the same. It's across this border. It's just that the direction has changed. And it was especially striking to see how the people of the border, the locals on all sides of that border, responded to this new influx of really mostly desperate people. And there was a variety of reactions I encountered, from great kindness and generosity and compassion, which often came from people's own ancestral histories. You know, a lot of the people who live along that border in all three countries, Bulgaria, Greece and Turkey, are descendants of refugees from the Balkan Wars exactly 100 years ago. So there was a lot of compassion I saw, but I also saw resistance, fear, suspicion of the other. Yeah, the whole spectrum of human emotions was there. But what I found the most affecting, what was most affecting for me was to meet with some of the refugees and spend a bit of time with them and hear their stories. And their stories are very much part of that border's story now.
And as we say there, there's been these flows of migration through this area over centuries, really. And one of the migrations that you comment on, I think, is worth reflecting on. It would be interesting for the listeners as well, because it's not very well known, and it should probably be much better known in the outside world. And that's the expulsion of the Turks from Bulgaria in 1989, which was basically a kind of ethnic purge in which around 340,000 Turkish origin Bulgarians were basically forced out of the country into Turkey. And you described it at one point as the largest movement of people in Europe since World War II. And amazingly, it happened just months before the Berlin Wall came down. So there's another great irony there. Could you just talk about this episode, this little-known episode, and what it tells us, what it can tell us about the area?
You're absolutely right. It happened just, that's another of the eye of the terrible ironies, just a few months before the border effectively opened to all. So it was a tragedy. It was an unnecessary tragedy. It was also the largest movement of people in Europe since World War II, but it happened in peacetime, which makes it even more appalling, really, more extraordinary that this purge was done in peacetime and it was inflicted by the state on its own people. It was entirely an internal purge. It was really one of those situations, I think, where a kind of dying regime, you know, a dying dinosaur of a regime, in this case, the Bulgarian communist government, is looking for scapegoats, is looking for ways to distract the population from the obvious problems, such as a failed economy or a failing economy, lack of civil rights. And of course, the winds of glasnost and perestroika were blowing in. So it was really a kind of diversionary tactic, a very cynical act, a very cynical kind of hate campaign on the part of the state. It was a fully orchestrated hate campaign against the ethnic Turks of Bulgaria. And it wasn't the first to happen in Bulgaria, this kind of campaign against Muslims in particular. There had been earlier attempts to change Muslim names to, you know, as it were, Christianize people, even though that in itself is ironic because religion was banned. So if you weren't allowed to go to church, you know, what logic is there in Christianizing anyone? But, you know, this whole story is full of terrible ironies. But the upshot was that around 350,000 people left the country and migrated to Turkey, often in quite dramatic circumstances, having lost everything. Many stayed, took the new names, families were divided and separated. Many returned a couple of years later from Turkey, but it changed their lives forever. And I tried to tell the story of this sort of mass exodus in a more intimate way in Border.
And you find some of the survivors, really, of this particular migration. How did you find people? I mean, when you first arrived and decided to start traveling around in this old Renault that you drive in, what was your plan? How did you decide to go about meeting people? Was it just a kind of snowball effect, or was it something more deliberate?
Well, it was a combination of the two. It was, you know, counting on traveler's luck, but also there was a degree of preparation. And I always intended to visit the two twin cities of the Bulgarian-Turkish border, Svilengrad and Edirne. And having visited those cities, which are very much border cities in terms of their mentality, their trade, their people, their stories, it was very easy, I was in Edirne, to meet Bulgarian Turks. In fact, there are entire neighborhoods in Edirne, also in Istanbul, where Bulgarian Turks have settled, and they are all migrants from that traumatic exodus in the summer of 1989. So there are many, many untold stories among their community. I could only tell one or two, but I was very aware that this remains very much an untold human story. And I hope there will be more films, more books, more narratives about it. I think we can learn from people who have been through an experience like that, where they've had to remake themselves from scratch on the other side, as it were, almost like crossing the Styx and sort of being reborn on the other side, if you're lucky. Very, very moving stories of survival and ingenuity. And what I found particularly moving was that almost all the Bulgarian Turks I spoke to in Turkey not almost, all of them had somehow managed to retain a positive attitude towards Bulgarians at large, as if they understood or they wanted to believe that it was really a state, it had been a state campaign against them, not a civilian campaign. And I found that very humbling.
Now, I mean, over on the other side of the border in Bulgaria, one of the things that you comment on is this kind of sense of nostalgia. Obviously, a lot of these areas that you travel through are very beautiful, like mountainous, forested regions, but there's not really much going on there anymore economically, and there's a huge migration away for that reason of people, of locals away from the area. So despite this kind of grim Soviet history of these parts of the Balkans, you noted, you know, that there's this distinct nostalgia among many locals. Could you just talk about this paradoxical sense of nostalgia a little?
Indeed, there is a sense of nostalgia, perhaps not only in border villages, but elsewhere too, in Bulgaria and also in the former Eastern Bloc, former communist countries. But yes, it's particularly acute in those areas, like the border villages, which have been really devastated by the crash of the economy, by migration, by sudden change. I guess people, not all of them, but those who do feel nostalgic, simply miss having people around them. I mean, these are half-empty villages. There are no young people or very few. The children are gone. You know, the women are old. Very few young people settle there because there is effectively no economy. It's a kind of devastated area. Incidentally, I found a similar thing on the other side of the border in Greece and in Turkey, perhaps to a lesser extent. It's an area of survival, you know, bare survival. And still, again, very humblingly, you see people making the most of it, you know, drumming up small businesses for themselves, small jobs, somehow scraping by, and this love they have for, you know, for their native villages, for these beautiful sort of super fertile you know, forests and fields. It's very moving, it's very sad, and it does beg the question of what the future holds. And one answer is that, you know, if there was enough smart sort of governmental policy for ecotourism, you know, to encourage small businesses in ecotourism, this could well be one way to go, because these are stunning natural sites, and they could, you know, given a bit of infrastructure, given a bit of publicity, attract travelers, tourists, nature lovers, hikers, bird watchers. Yeah, not just poachers and smugglers. So there is hope. There is a way forward. But I just, what I found was that the vision was lacking. There were locals with tremendous vision and ideas, but when there is no capital, when there is no help at all from the government, and moreover, when there is kind of environmental depredation and damage going on, which worryingly you see in some of these natural parks on both sides of the border, that doesn't bode well. Because in a way, you know, nature is the last remaining wealth of the border region. Nature, natural resources, rivers, forests, rare plants and animals, that's all that's left.
One of the most moving parts of the book, I think, is where you're traveling through this forested area, I think between the border of Bulgaria and Greece. And of course, it's full of trees. And this was a route that people were traveling through as they tried to flee and cross into Greece and Turkey. And it was full of trees where you found initials carved into the trunks of people who were commemorating their moment of fleeing. Some of these people made it through, some of them wouldn't have made it through, but it's impossible to tell from just the initials that are carved into the trees. Could you just talk a bit about this area and what that kind of stirred in you as you were deciding to commit it to the page?
Wasn't an extraordinary kind of place, a haunted place, really. You know, the forest of names and dates, and there were all sorts of dates there. You know, from the 40s to the 90s, different eras of desperation. You know, the earlier it was the wars, including the Greek Civil War, at the end of which, in fact, people were fleeing northwards from Greece into Bulgaria and Albania. But yes, some of the initials were from as late as the 1990s, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, when in fact the Bulgarian-Greek border was still hard, as it were, because Greece was in the EU and Bulgaria wasn't. So a great number of Bulgarians who found themselves out of jobs, and it was the decade of unemployment and recession, found themselves crossing that border illegally with the help of smugglers. And many of them had left their initials in no man's forest, next to the older initials. And it's an extraordinary thing to come across. And it was in more than one place. There seemed to be pockets of these forests.
And of course, if people didn't make it across the border, as hundreds didn't, they'd be caught by the border guards, and that was the end. They'd be killed.
Well, not in the 90s. If we're still in the 90s, that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
But up until 1989, yes. In fact, I thought I would mention in the book one of the last victims, if not the last victim of the Bulgarian-Greek border. And that was an East German guy who was 19 when he tried to cross on his own. And he was shot by a Bulgarian border guard his age. And this happened countless times. In fact, it's impossible to ascertain how many times, how many people were executed at this border. There are records for some of them, but not all. But we can safely assume that there were at least in the hundreds, if not in the thousands, of all nationalities, from East Europeans to Poles to Czechs to Chechens, and of course Bulgarians. Interestingly, though, the greatest number of successful escapes, perhaps not surprisingly, in fact, were Bulgarians, especially locals who knew the area well and knew the more vulnerable parts of the electric fence. So there are a lot of fascinating stories of successful escapes as well, and I mention a few of those.
Now, the book is highly lyrical, and there's actually a kind of spiritual dimension as well. One of the things that you reflect on is this idea that this is a kind of very mysterious land of wild, ancient, deep-rooted rituals. And there was a kind of brief interlude of sort of communist, atheistic dogma. But this was really just a brief interruption of a kind of more essential undercurrent of this area. You talk at one point, you say Christianity is just a fig leaf for a primal spiritual practice. Could you just reflect on this kind of notion of the kind of underlying kind of deep-rooted spiritual aspect of this part of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. It's paganism that lives on. There's a tremendous sense of ancientness in some of these areas. In particular, there are two regions that I spent time in. They are quite separate from one another, but they are both demarcations of the border between Bulgaria and Greece and Turkey in the south. And they are the Rhodope Ranges in Bulgaria and Greece, and the Stranja, or Yıldız in Turkish, ranges in Bulgaria and Turkey. Now, in the Rhodope Mountains, there's there's an ancient history there, but there's also a specific music tradition which some link to Thracian Orphic rituals. It's hard, of course, to trace things that far back because there are no records. But there is a sense of tremendous kind of timelessness, really. Sometimes you see it even in the houses, they're fortress-like. You even see it in the faces of people to this day. There's something stony and ancient, and really, when you look at time, you know, historically, but also geologically, because these are very sort of old geological formations, really the Cold War was just a blink. It was a very, very brief interruption of this kind of enduring relationship between man and nature. The paganism that you mentioned, for which Christianity is merely a fig leaf, is especially strong in the Stranger ranges, Stranger Yıldız, where, especially on the Bulgarian side, where certain rites are still performed. Somehow they have been revived, from the sort of freeze of the Cold War, where you can still see firewalking and a certain form of fire worship, which is clearly very old, some would say ancient. Thinking about the Dionysian and Orphic practices that took place in those lands. But they are certainly traceable back to the late Middle Ages. So all of that is not really subject to ideology. There are certain things which have survived almost miraculously after not just the oppression of the Cold War and the censorship and the clamping down on all forms of worship or spirituality, but have also survived the great sort of disruptions of the Balkan Wars and the huge sort of movement of people, the so-called exchange of populations that took place. And in fact, the firewalking ritual that comes from Stranger involved mostly populations that were unsettled, that were uprooted and forced to move across the border in both directions. And that makes it harder, perhaps, for students of that practice, of that spiritual practice, to kind of find sufficient sources. You know, people were disrupted too many times. Things were lost, houses burnt down. And still it survives. I find that amazing.
And of course, the book is released at a kind of very apposite moment because there are hard borders going up. I think the border with Bulgaria and Turkey has got a huge wall now. There's obviously a wall that's going up on the border, on the Turkish border with Syria. And across Eastern Europe, there are these hard borders going up everywhere, and there's a resurgence of nationalism. Was that something you were aware of when you started writing the book? And was there a particular message that you wanted to get across on this subject as you were writing?
I wasn't particularly thinking along these lines because I really started writing it more than 3 years ago. And really, I wanted to focus on the legacy of the Cold War above all, because that's quite close to my heart because of my childhood, because of the awareness of what went on. But I, as it happened, history unfolded before my eyes as I traveled in the area, and so various unplanned stories and voices wrote themselves into the book. As I said, all I had to do was listen. And I think in terms of wanting a message to be kind of, people to get a message from the book or any kind. No, this is a book without an agenda, but I think that every person in this book, every story, there is a multiplicity, a kind of polyphony of voices and stories there, has something to tell us, something that is reflected in our present as history unfolds before our eyes now. I think the people of the border, have something to teach us.
That was Kapka Kasabova. Thank you to her. You can read my review of her book, Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe, at the Hürriyet Daily News. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. The latest addition to the list is Olivier Roy's new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State. To check out the other books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, HearstPublishers.bigcartel.com. Also remember to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page, or do both, to stay updated with new episodes. Email me with recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And remember, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Beyarslan, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.
dinle dinle amma.